Aren't you a technology supplier looking for deal flow? Then you should try our new platform, Connect. It's designed to help buyers and brands find the best tech solutions to match their campaign requirements. It's free for buyers to use and for tech suppliers to set up an account and start applying to campaign briefs. Set up your account today by visiting exchangewire.com/connect or email us at info@thewirecorp.com.
The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire. Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the MadTech Podcast. Delighted to welcome our very, very special guest for today, Ed Preedy, CRO from Cavi.
Delighted to be here and thank you both for welcoming me.
Not at all. Great to have you. And Lindsay Rowntree in the Walthamstow Studios. How's things over in East London this morning, Lindsay?
Internet dramas. I'm in my other podcast studio today, which is far more echoey than my normal one. So Sound Guy is going to love me.
Yeah, actually, good point. I only just noticed it when you said that. And just as you did, there was a little bit of Frozen Lindsay going on. So, yeah, there's more Frozen Lindsay. Let's dive into first news story of the week that I wanted to chat through with the two of you. And this is Google's announcement that Flock, or the Federated Learning of Cohorts, I sort of feel like that's a potential clan from Star Trek. Federated Learning of Cohorts is the mechanism that will replace third-party cookies in the Chrome browser when they are no longer supported, which is due to be from January 2022. So the idea is that Flock will form part of Google's Privacy Sandbox, which is a suite of tools that they'll be using to power their own advertising platforms. Flock itself is an API tool that will enable targeting based on users' general interests, which will be done by clustering together groups of users based on search terminology with similar interests, thereby forming a cohort. API used for Flock isn't going to enable other things that have been reliant on third-party cookies to date, such as measurement, fraud prevention, and retargeting. Google say that they're developing separate proposals for tools to potentially address some of those issues. And there's also not a lot of detailed information available at the moment as to exactly how detailed those cohorts will be, that they will adhere to data privacy policies and laws and policy procedures that Google wants to put in place, ensuring that people are grouped into cohorts that aren't based on too much personally identifiable information or sensitive information, such as race and sexuality, for example. So my question to the two of you is, how useful do you think Flock will be in the pursuit of some form of personalized or targeted advertising? And what is the industry going to have to do to adopt this tool from a practical point of view? Ed, what's your point of view?
I think it will be useful for advertisers and, you know, their respective agencies or buying arms that have currently a big reliance on audience or interest-based targeting via third-party cookies. Coming from Google, you'll feel like it will at least be a scaled alternative that they can start testing as time's running out, right? For the third-party cookie, there's been no extension on, I think it's by January 2022, right, that it's going to be phased out completely. So, and I've not seen a wholesale shift away from the third-party cookie in any meaningful way in the targeting that's currently happening. In terms of the benefits for the industry and the wider ecosystem, I've never been a huge fan of audience and or interest-based targeting, particularly via third-party cookies, which Flock is, you know, seeking to replicate the function of, I guess, in some capacity. I've always believed that there is some fundamental effectiveness that is lost from an ad placement when you remove it from directly relevant or supportive contexts. You know, I think a travel ad on a travel site or on a relevant travel content page offers a far more real-world benefit as a stimulus for interaction from a user than targeting that same user with a travel ad days later in a totally unrelated context. So I don't see that the launch of Flock will address my fundamental issue with interest-based targeting. You know, I think behavioral targeting was launched initially to augment contextual targeting because you obviously have some limits of scale with contextual, but it kind of ended up replacing it in quite a significant way, which I felt was damaging for display ad effectiveness and certainly damaging to publishers who create content that can be the most fertile ground for display advertising in a very real sense.
Ever since early discussions around Google discontinuing the availability of third-party cookies in the Chrome browser, there's been an ongoing conversation about contextual versus third-party cookie targeting and tracking. And there's a lot of people have said that they felt, you know, contextual can yield just as good results, in fact, better. So are we going to return to that debate? And I guess I'm interested to hear your point of view on that, Ed. But Lindsay, let's just come to you first, because I want to know in general what you think and what you think specifically about that context alternative.
I think I agree with Ed about his opinions on interest-based advertising and its downfall, its pitfalls, basically. And I think that I've been so used to, as we all have, so used to being targeted for anything in any environment, in any context or out of context environment, that I thought how nice it almost feels to actually receive a contextual ad. So yeah. I'm on a website and I see it's relevant to what I'm doing or what I'm looking at that time. And I'm like, oh, this is actually interesting for me.
Yeah. That is exactly what I was thinking as Ed was describing his issues.
Exactly that. It reminds me, I'm much more likely to be buying cooking apparatus. I've just recently bought some frying pans. So this is going to come up quite a lot probably. And they are retargeting the hell out of me everywhere I go. Now, if I'd seen, I've already bought them. So obviously the standard issue with retargeting is that normally you've bought stuff already and they're still retargeting you because they don't get access to sale data, only normally basket data. But I think that the problem is if I was products advertised to me while I was on the BBC Good Food website or app, I'd be in a far better position to actually want to go and buy them than if I'm on some random news site the last thing I want to do is look at bloody saucepans. So I think that it's reminded me of how annoying interest-based targeting, interest-based advertising can be. But I think that what actually I found interesting, Ed, was what you said about the fact that there's not really been any meaningful reduction in the use of third-party cookies. And what you would kind of expect was that when Google announced they were going to deprecate them, and obviously Mozilla and Safari, Apple already have done, when that announcement came, you would expect to see meaningful reduction in the use of them. You'd expect advertisers to go, okay, what's my alternative? Let's look into contextual opportunities. Let's see what else we can look at so we're not relying on the third-party cookie. And the fact that that's not really happening for advertisers, particularly probably the kind of the less savvy ones that aren't really kind of on top of their data targeting and how they use their data, it does show that this flock is going to need to be what those advertisers are going to be using. Like there isn't a viable alternative at the moment apart from this flock. But it does raise, I mean, the 95% effectiveness figure that they've put out there. They have since released some insight. I'm using air quotes here as to where that number came from because it's all a bit kind of wishy-washy and flaky and doesn't make a lot of sense. I think there's a few publishers that have published the data that they've shared. I say data, it's not data, it's just a random assortment of words that they think make sense into things. But the 95% figure they've said, it's 95% as effective as third-party cookie-based targeting, this new flock and interest-based targeting. I guess, some people are saying that's absolute rubbish. Where's the number come from? I can't believe that. I guess that I'm not that surprised if it's not, because who's to say that me being in a cohort based on what I'm searching for and the websites I visit, the adverts probably and the conversion rate probably will be as effective as if you were targeting me based on much more intricate data about my personally identifiable information. But does that mean that you should and you could? And there is the question and the concern around privacy amongst this as well, which Google say they are, you know, they are taking measures to ensure discrimination doesn't happen. But if I have some kind of health or medical problem and I am searching for those things on websites, I'm Googling them, whatever else, or if I'm of a particular, particular influence in certain ways, and that Google is saying that we will not include those, it's very difficult for people like that to believe that they won't be included and believe they won't be discriminated in some way. And that there's a lot of obviously concerns around the privacy aspect that Google haven't really filled people with confidence about.
The other consideration is the publishers, right? You know, how this benefits them. So I mean, presumably these interest cohorts will command a price premium of sorts. So will it mean that, you know, more revenue gets filtered through to the publisher of source than potentially currently happens with, you know, multiple third parties involved in the sort of transaction? And if you're, you know, the source, the publishers are also the source of the data, right? I presume that props up these cohorts. So do they get rewarded in some capacity for that? You know, so again, if you're a travel site and you have produced a crucial piece of profiling data, you know, a user landing on your page about trips to New York or whatever. Bit depressing talking about travel at the moment, isn't it? But
taunting us.
Do they get rewarded for contributing to the building of that profile? And do they benefit? You know, they would benefit from a reset in our industry that really, you know, puts context at the center, because people selling flights to New York would outbid each other for what is actual really valuable kind of real estate, as opposed to a user being profiled because they've read that page and then another publisher benefiting that is sort of completely outside of the initial seed publisher's network.
Google will not reward publishers. They will argue that publishers have always been the source of a lot of data that Google has access to anyway. So this in that regard is no different. But you'd like to think, Ed, to your point, you'd like to think that advertisers would pay a premium to target these cohorts. So you would assume that it would result in probably not the same levels of revenue that they would get from the use of third party data to the extent that it's been in the past, but compared to a purely contextual environment where there isn't a premium basically, and revenue is much, much lower for them, you'd imagine that you'd hope that they would get more revenue from that.
I'm going to move us on to second news story of the week. Sony has purchased AT&T's anime studio Crunchyroll for $1.2 billion, and that is somewhat shining a light on the growing popularity of TV and film adaptation of Japanese manga. So interesting article appeared in the FT this week, speaking about, or connecting rather, the popularity of the Demon Slayer franchise, which Sony already own via ownership of the studio that produces it, together with their acquisition of Crunchyroll, and using that as a pinpoint to suggest that this is not only evidence of the growing popularity of Japanese animation, but it's also drawing the attention of global streaming giants such as Netflix and Disney, who are looking at anime studios and their monetization models and wondering what they can learn from those to continue to build out their streaming content. So monetization sort of strategies that typically associated with anime studios are obviously anything earned from the content directly and the content rights, but also merchandising and syndicating that content or drawing that content out into alternative channels or additional channels such as gaming and music. And I guess what's interesting about this is thinking for a little while that if the consumption of anime is growing, and perhaps that's partly being fueled by the ways in which we're accessing that content through streaming, which is becoming increasingly popular, then are we going to see a little sort of additional contribution from anime as an entertainment, part of the entertainment industry, to what we often refer to as the streaming wars? So, you know, the likes of the digital first streamers, Netflix and Amazon, and how they're continuing to build out their business models and acquire share of market, versus, you know, the likes of the content owners and the broadcasters, traditional broadcasters such as Disney and AT&T, and how they're continuing to build their content empire. My question to the two of you, anime experts, is can you see the anime industry continuing to become a bit more mainstream and perhaps further fuel the consumption of streamed content? I suppose also maybe given we'll have a chat about the demographic that it largely appeals to. And then also, could you imagine seeing other content owners, either original content providers or content owners, so Netflix or Disney, looking at these anime studio business models and trying to adopt a similar approach for their own original content? So thinking about merchandising, syndicating to other channels and branching out into gaming and music and other opportunities. And I'm going to go with you because you confessed at the start that your children are into anime, so you are that by proxy makes you the expert in this conversation.
Oh, yeah. I appreciate the work anime has done babysitting my children while the thing. So, it's really interesting. And out of the top 25 media franchises, highest grossing media franchises ever, the top two are Japanese animation-based franchises. So, namely, Pokemon, and number two is Hello Kitty. So, that's... You know, and they're significantly higher grossing than Star Wars and all the major franchises that we consider here. Yeah. And out of that top 25, a further 9 of that were Japanese animations. So, you know, you've got all the ones that, you know, in the West we acknowledge as household names, and then a range of anime in there that, it, you know, really to my mind has yet to achieve critical global mass. So the revenue it's generating is based around the business models that it has in the parts of the globe that it's popular. And I think you can definitely learn a lot from how they productize, package, that the whole franchising model with anime is baked into its very inception. So all the wheels of the games and the supermarket food sponsorships and music, all the wheels are turning at the same time. And, you know, I think we've had sort of very successful movie Western franchises. So, you know, Disney's obviously very adept at building franchises with longevity, but we've not really sort of seen that from the streaming services yet, and a streaming service like Netflix and the content, you know, the great content that it produces with Netflix's global footprint, there's definitely an opportunity for them to create new revenue, new streams via franchising. I think the one series they had that kind of started to do that was Stranger Things, because I think there was certainly by series 3 there was a PlayStation Stranger Things game that came out, and there was definitely lots of merchandise. But again, it was kind of reactive to the success of the series and not sort of baked in at its inception that this is the model that we use to launch successful series. For Sony, I think that the anime series Demon Slayer has served a very important purpose for them in unifying what were very siloed pillars within Sony of movies, music, and games, because it's sort of been so successful across all three. It's kind of apparently broken down some of the boundaries within Sony across these disciplines, which they found enormously beneficial. So I would certainly think that anime is going to grow in popularity. I mean, it's already there. And from a global perspective, another thing was that we're at an inflection point now where 50% of the revenue from Japanese-produced anime is generated overseas. So it's, you know, it's here and it's very popular, and it has a very progressive and high-yielding business model at its very core.
Definitely the anime expert there. But Lindsay, what have you got to say that? Are we all going to be walking around with, I don't know, Ozarks, lunch, pack up lunch boxes and, you know, I'm just trying to think of other Netflix series that could be, you know, merchandised, franchise merchandised. Is that going to happen?
Are they going to make Ozarks into anime? I mean,
that would be good.
This is a weird analogy, but only because I was watching 30 Years of Mr. Bean, because when I was a child, I was a fan of Mr. Bean, so make of that what you will. And they talked about the fact that Mr. Bean was made into a cartoon, and it's a really it's an absolute cash cow for all the creators of Mr. Bean. And it was Rowan Atkinson's idea to do it. And Richard Curtis said, don't be an idiot. No, I do not want to be involved in that. And he says, I'm still getting checks every week for it. I know so little about anime. I'm intrigued, Rachel, that before we started recording this, you had it in your mind that I might be a closet anime fan. And in reality, I've never even watched Pokemon. So I don't know.
And now that you've mentioned Mr. Bean, that makes much more sense.
You get it now.
I don't know where I was going with that.
Much more my style. It's come through with all of the stats there. It's absolutely fascinating. And I do think that there is so much opportunity in Europe and North America for anime, and obviously Netflix has anime content on it already. I don't think there's probably so much more it could do with it. And you do wonder if there's more anime content that could be created that is targeting those particular regions and not just targeting. At the moment, we are consuming Japanese anime or consuming Asian produced anime, but actually there could be an argument for anime that's produced and created in these regions that's more, I guess, more applicable to the area that they're from, that there could be opportunities there. But I think that if you look at the merchandising, the monetization of revenue opportunities is a big thing here. And kind of like Ed was alluding to, that it's not just that revenue comes from other sources based off the fact that a series is popular. It is almost an ecosystem from the very outset.
Standalone. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not just the fact that, I love this, it's popular, I now want to, you know, they've just released this, they've just released that in relation to it. It all gets released at once. You become one of the characters. It is an ecosystem, and the gaming opportunities and the merchandise opportunities for these things are massive. And I think that Disney is someone that could do well in this, because Disney, from the animation perspective, if the pandemic has showed us one thing, it showed us the power of animation, because in a world where people couldn't go and actually film TV or movies in studios, they were able to go and invest in animation instead. So there's a huge opportunity in animation, and I think that the desire and demand for animation has probably grown massively over that time as well. And in particular, anime, people that believe they completed Netflix are probably watching the anime section of Netflix thinking, what the hell is this? And now they're probably massively into it. Certainly somebody using my Netflix has been doing so. Don't know who.
There we go.
Wasn't me. Want to add, but I think it's an area that people have explored this year they probably wouldn't have done before, and that just represents huge opportunity. I think Netflix have an opportunity here to try and create this sort of ecosystem play, but it's brand new to them. They haven't done anything like this before. So how they go about it would be interesting, whereas Disney would be in a much better position to do so, as would Sony.
Third news story of the week. Twitter, in an attempt to address misleading information and the challenges that they're provided with over that on their platform, have introduced a community-driven fact-checking system called Birdwatch. So the idea behind the system is pretty basic, to their own admission, is that community users and contributors will have the opportunity to add labels and context to certain tweets to, you know, to either flag that they're misinformation or to, you know, to flag specific things about the content that relates to fact checking. The idea is that this information will sit on a separate site. Birdwatch will be a self-contained site, so there'll be a link from the tweet to Birdwatch. And the content or the comments and the contextual sort of comments and moderation will be rateable for usefulness. Obviously, the risk here is that anyone that's getting involved in the user-led communities that are commenting or providing context on the tweets could also be those that are providing misinformation. So it could be very easy for players or organised communities that are looking to infiltrate social media platforms for misinformation to also participate in Birdwatch. But Twitter's response to that potential concern that had been flagged by others is, well, it's better than doing nothing and let's just give it a go and see what happens next. So they're trialling it at the moment and slowly rolling it out across a number of international marketplaces. My question to you guys is, has the inability of these social platforms to deal with, you know, or to control misinformation presented a brand risk for marketers that's just one step too far? And are we going to see marketers really retreat from spending in these environments as the proliferation of misinformation grows? So is Birdwatch going to be a useful tool? Is it too little too late? Is it actually going to be, you know, practically applicable? And then I guess my second question is, do you think that these platforms are doing enough to address misinformation and taking personal responsibility for them, or is Birdwatch another example of, you know, platforms like Twitter relying on user-generated, not just user-generated content, but now user-generated moderation of that content in order to weed out misinformation?
I guess you'd say it's kind of in a beta mode now, wouldn't you, with in the US. I don't know exactly how many people they've got signed up to be the bird watching moderators. So in terms of like brands and their approach to social platforms, I mean, they're getting these issues, not just the misinformation issue, but the use of data, the issue that sort of blew up around WhatsApp and Facebook. And then particularly with Twitter, the nature of a lot of the debate that goes on there, coupled with the misinformation. I mean, you regularly hear members, not people in our industry, but members of the public, I guess your average punters, refer to platforms as cesspits, don't you? So because of the degree of content of people arguing and you know, large swathes of it being quite, you know, aggressive and nasty in tone. So I guess if brands were employing a kind of more traditional approach in the way that they used to assess publishers and the brand equity that they might get from running on a major respectable news title, for example, and the relationship that news title had with its readers based around loyalty and trust and all that. Are brands getting equity from the social media platforms that they're advertising in that respect? I guess that's questionable. And certainly up for debate. I think the problems with Birdwatch, which you've touched on, is will these groups that are the moderators from the community, how will they themselves get prevented from being corrupted in some way and sort of adding to the problem potentially? So I'm sure that there will be measures put in place. And we've obviously had high-profile examples of misinformation recently, and I guess that moderating accounts that have big numbers of followers is kind of easier to do than, say, you know, you've got 100,000 accounts with 20 to 30 followers each, but these 100,000 accounts are all feeding misinformation. That kind of ratchets up suddenly, doesn't it? You know, a big grouping of apparently inconsequential accounts all spreading misinformation. So how easily is that policed by a group of these bird watchers, as they're called?
Lindsay?
Yeah, I agree with Ed. I don't think it's enough because there's Twitter is almost too easy to abuse in that regard. And just because you put a content warning on a tweet from Trump or you remove his account, those that already think Trump's an idiot will go, yes, quite right, you should be moderating his content. But those that think that Trump is the best thing since sliced bread will just go, who is Jack Dorsey? Who are Twitter to say whether what Trump says is right or wrong? And my question is, how much are those that are in the middle being influenced by these moderated content tweets? Like, people will believe what they want to believe. And if they see if they see these moderation tags, will they just think that that's just the system trying to suppress free speech, especially in the United States, where free speech is obviously a huge, huge thing for them and a constitutional right? But I feel like if you're an advertiser investing in Twitter, you are kind of doing so at your own risk to a certain degree, because Twitter is Twitter and Facebook are more free for all than maybe Instagram is, because Instagram is where you show your ideal life and what you want to be like. Twitter is where you're honest about everything, and and Facebook is where all the crazies live, I think. But it's, if you are going to be investing in that environment, you do run your risk, and you have to take whatever steps you can to try to make sure that you are not appearing alongside potentially inappropriate content. But it is tough to do, and you can use suppression lists and block lists as much as you like, but it's still a massive challenge, and Twitter doesn't necessarily help you. I don't see how a community of bird watchers is going to necessarily be able to mitigate the risk for advertisers that want to invest in Twitter, but also mitigate the risk for users. I do think it's too little too late. I just don't see how. I think that keyword blocking isn't enough in a world where context means everything. And I think that, you know, if you've ever seen the documentary called Agents of Chaos, it's a brilliant documentary. It talks about how Russia hacked, Rachel's writing it down. Russia, yep. It's talking about how Trump went into power, basically, but how it goes into detail about how Russia basically used Twitter and Facebook to promote this. And they just had a bunch of teenagers sitting in a dodgy old office somewhere in the middle of Russia that were able to create these fake accounts, like hundreds of them per minute, and just keep posting. And unless you can get each one of those accounts that looks completely normal and moderate those, you're not going to get anywhere, because it's just too easy to abuse.
To what extent does it address the wider issue, which is why the proliferation of misinformation exists in any case? I mean, you know, there is a difference between different opinions and different points of view and manufactured sort of organized misinformation.
Yeah.
That sort of organized, manufactured misinformation needs to be tackled at much more of a strategic level, and moderating, you know, a range of opinions and making sure nobody's being offensive or doing anything illegal is a separate matter. Where do marketers sit in all of this? What ought they be doing? And Lindsay, you raise a good point. If you're going to advertise in platforms that have got a high volume of, you know, controversial conversations, then you're going to have to expect to deal with some of the challenges that come along with that. But that's what makes me wonder whether brands will just escape those environments altogether in the not too distant future and think, you know what, that isn't the same. Well, it's nowhere near the same as advertising in a contextual environment where we know what's happening. And I also think all of that together brings us back to the debate of what are those platforms actually providing us with in terms of content? If it is all user-generated content, then what value does that actually have?
I think it's kind of, to be fair to Twitter, I mean, they did towards the end of last year, I think, they've opened up to Double Verify and IAS, haven't they, to sort of moderate and give advertisers a view on the context around which their ads are placed. And I think it's a complex issue, isn't it? Because part of the appeal of these platforms is they allow at scale people to express themselves. You know, that is part of the popularity, which creates these scaled up platforms that are so attractive to marketers, because it's relatively easy to reach your audience. Advertisers and marketers use social platforms because they kind of work. It's that there's always that balance of, you know, what I'm getting out of this advertising is, does it make the risks and the other stuff worthwhile? I just kind of wish that politicians hadn't started tweeting en masse in the first place. I sort of remember years ago, I mean, it's been years now that they've all been on there, but I just remember feeling at the time a bit uncomfortable about it. But I thought that's because my perception of Twitter at the time, like 10, 15 years ago, whatever, was that it was a vehicle for celebrities to do kind of mundane updates about what they're up to. And it felt kind of frivolous and demeaning for elected officials to be doing that. But obviously it became and still is a huge part of the way politicians communicate with constituents and to the wider public. So, and it gives Twitter a lot of prestige having them all on there. So, but it comes with problems, doesn't it?
It's interesting listening to you illustrate it like that, though, Ed, because that makes me think of it as a broadcast channel. But if it was a broadcast channel, if it was actually categorized as a broadcast channel, it would have to behave in a completely different way.
It would be heavily regulated.
Yeah. And that's where the debate starts to, you know, get complicated. But anyway, rather than getting us dragged into a complicated debate about that, Ed, let's hear a little bit more about what you're up to at Kavai.
So more broadly, we're a digital advertising creative platform, but we have conversational advertising uniquely at our core. And what conversational advertising is, again, in a wider sense, is the facilitation of conversations between advertisers and potential customers. And from the advertiser's point of view, these conversations are to meet specific advertising objectives, you know, most commonly selling products and services. Now, what we've done is we've created a platform with proprietary conversational software that's integrated or delivered within the global display ecosystem. So we serve conversations on behalf of advertisers to users in a kind of messaging app style. So for the advertisers, they are able to, via this conversational mechanism, pull users through the purchase funnel and deep link them via the ads to the most relevant part of the website. So the ads do a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of qualifying user interest. So you're effectively using the ad as a gateway or a traffic filter to make the traffic that you drive through a conversational ad far more efficient and with more ROI. And then it's a user on the user side. It's a user-centric solution because the users control the conversation. So they're getting from the advertiser the information they want via the answers that to the questions they select. So, you know, typically, you know, if it's a travel company, I keep using travel. I'm sorry, everyone.
Stop doing that, Ed. I mean, yes. You know, come on.
So it could be, you know, are you looking to buy a new car in the next 6 months? Yes, no, maybe, you know. So the user controls that interaction. And then if they say yes, then the advertiser can say, what type of car, you know, do you have a family? So it's giving the advertiser all this crucial information and meanwhile creating real engagement for the user and real relevancy for the user. So it serves a multi-purpose. And going back to what we were talking about at the top of the program about interest-based targeting approaches versus contextual, you know, we see I mean, I've always seen this, but you see a much higher real-world interaction from a user when you place an ad contextually. And we're seeing this with conversational ads.
Have you been experiencing, sort of more demand from brands and agencies over the last, say, 12 months or so, as, again, relating us to the first conversation that we had at the start of this podcast, as third-party cookie targeting and tracking is becoming less available? Are you seeing more interest from brands and advertisers in these type of advertising formats?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I'd say there's an appetite for you know, experimentation, with reference to the point that I made earlier, that there's not yet a wholesale shift. There's definitely appetite. People are definitely aware of the changes that are coming. And we think we've got, with the conversational format, we think we've got a very good front-end solution to the deprecation of the third-party cookie. Because, you know, with the example I used of the car, you know, rather than with third-party cookies, the methodology is gathering data and making assumptions that someone might be in market for a car. With a conversational ad, you can just ask them and you find out within the ad experience, are you in market for a car? Yeah, if so, which kind? So we think that it's got one foot planted neatly in the cookied world that we're still in, but also one foot forward very much so in the cookieless kind of world that we are waiting for.
And I can imagine, you know, in an online consumption world, which has become even more, commonplace since the start of the pandemic, so we're all getting used to purchasing everything that we need in life online.
Yeah.
I think people are probably also more inclined to answer those sorts of questions, even in an advertising format, more honestly, in the hope that they might get diverted to some sort of form of a special offer or discount. Yeah. When you're used to purchasing online, and if you're in that mindset, and I'm not necessarily suggesting people always are when they're looking to purchase cars. I know in some markets that's becoming very commonplace and eventually it will be everywhere. But if you're more in that mindset, then you're more likely to engage with those ads in a very earnest way and actually get something out of it or feel as though you're in control of the value exchange, which that's, is, I guess, the important part here.
Yeah, no, absolutely, yeah. Interestingly, we saw last year, because there's a lot more opportunity within a conversational ad to educate and answer questions. And, you know, this time last year, we're all kind of lockdown veterans now, but this time last year, people had a ton of questions, say, about going to the supermarket. When should I go? Is it safe? What do I need to wear? You know, how are you going to protect, you know, my safety and your staff's safety? So we found very good use cases for distributing this information within conversational ads. We actually did a campaign for the Norwegian government, which ended up relieving a lot of pressure on their phone lines this time last year, with people phoning up with all their questions about coronavirus. So they just launched a huge campaign that just had a revolving conversation within various ad units.
Are you working with brands directly or brands through agencies? Both.
But both. I mean, we work predominantly, I'd say, with agencies. We're a global operation now. We've got offices across Europe, the US, and APAC. So there are all different types of conversations happening. We deal mostly with agencies, and we also deal a lot with publishers as well, who adopt our services to bring conversational performance and interactivity to their own kind of sites and ad offerings. So agencies, publishers, and advertisers, you know, in rotation are our partners.
Great. Excellent. Well, we look forward to hearing more about Kavai as you guys continue to grow. And thank you very much for joining us on the MedTech podcast this morning.
Well, it's been great fun. And thank you to you both. I hope to do it again soon.
Indeed. We'd love to have you back. Thanks very much, Lindsay.
Thank you, Rachel. Thank you, Ed. Thank you, Sound Guy.
Thank you, Sound Guy.
And that was
this week's MedTech podcast.